I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Dahlia Lithwick, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Dahlia is a senior editor at Slate, where she writes about the courts and the law, and she's the host of the Amicus podcast about the law and the nine Supreme Court justices who interpret it. And now she is the author of the book Lady Justice, just out this week. It profiles the women lawyers and judges at the center of some of the most heated legal and political battles of the Trump administration. Dahlia, what inspired you to write this book?
First of all, thank you, Kimberly, for having me. And second of all, I think it was women and law that inspired me. I think there's been many, many, many books about Trump and law, about Trump and politics, about law. And I think I wanted to build a little bit of what seemed to me a pretty evident bridge between what I see as a kind of special relationship or special connection between women and the law and the rule of law and the necessity of law. And so I wanted to really think about, and I don't know if I'm correct about this, if there are ways in which particularly the women lawyers in the book who I profile, who really all were kind of a bulwark against lawlessness and continue to be a bulwark against lawlessness, if there's something special going on there that women rise to or meet the moment in a way using the tools of the law when it feels as though the law itself is fragile.
And you mentioned that there's a special relationship between women and the law. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, again, this is just me theorizing, but I think there's something kind of remarkable about the fact that if you look at the founding documents, if you look at the constitutional history, women were utterly invisible, right? I mean, at the founding, they were chattel, they were property, they belonged to their fathers and their husbands, and they were otherwise immaterial. I'm mindful of the fact that Abigail Adams tried to remind her husband as they were drafting the Constitution to remember the ladies. He did not. And so there's a way in which, and this becomes material, I'm sure we'll talk about Dobbs in a minute, but in the Dobbs decision, when Justice Alito essentially in the majority opinion just says, well, women and abortion were invisible at the founding. You are not here, so you're out of luck. And I think that maybe that puts women on this really interesting knife's edge. And I certainly don't mean only women. There are many, many communities of people who are also invisible in the founding documents, including people of color, including Native Americans, including children. But I think one of the things that my sense has become is that women, having fought really, really hard over centuries to kind of weave themselves into the fabric of the Constitution to claw out power, to say, no, we have a right to vote. We have a right to our own credit cards. We are not our husband's property. Nobody can rape us and say that it's legal because we're married. Having done all that work, we're both the beneficiaries of all that work. And also, I think it can turn on a dime, right? And that within two heartbeats, with the sweep of the pen, it can all be lost. And so I think for me, the theory of the case here was women are uniquely vulnerable to having the law used against them. And also, I think uniquely gifted, maybe because of that vulnerability, at repurposing the tools of the law to protect democracy and protect themselves.
You kick off the book talking about the oral arguments in Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt on March 2nd, 2016, and you call it, quote, the last truly great day for women and the legal system in America. Here's an exchange from those oral arguments. The exchange is between Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Chief Justice John Roberts.
We have absorbed so much of your time with the threshold question. Perhaps you can since you have some time to address the merits.
Why don't you take an extra 5 minutes and we'll be sure to afford you rebuttal time after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. So fundamentally, these laws impose heavy burden.
So I know we were both there, Dahlia. What was the significance of this case and these oral arguments and this exchange in particular?
I loved this exchange, Kimberly, and you know that in Justice Ginsburg's speech, that's kind of the functional equivalent of saying, give the advocate more time to talk about the merits. Like, she was not really asking the Chief Justice to give the advocate more time. She was, I think, saying women have waited 200 years to make some of these arguments about reproductive freedom, and Mr. Chief Justice, she's going to get a little extra time, right? And so I loved it because it was exactly how she operated, and I loved it because he deferred, right? Like, he's like, oh yeah, you best give her some extra time. So for me, I think I kind of keyed in on that exchange, but also on the larger arguments, because I mean, again, you were there. It was such a moment of feeling as though women were on the brink of something astounding. I mean, for the first time, three women sitting on the bench. We should remember that Roe v. Wade was decided by nine men. So was Griswold, the case that was its progenitor that protected the right to contraception in marriage. So to have a third of the bench, I know it's not half the bench, but a third of the bench as women who were showing up and pressing at oral arguments, women's interests, women's concerns. I want to be really mindful that Justice Breyer was very much involved in that roller derby. I mean, really deeply, deeply engaged with lifting up the women's perspective on this case. And for me, I really remember writing it up as, wow, we're there. We have women oral advocates. We have women on the bench. The whole point of the oral argument, and in fact, the decision that followed in Whole Women's Health, was that the state of Texas can't just, on pretextual basis, take away women's reproductive rights, say they're trying to protect the health of the mother, but in fact are really just trying to close down clinics without being probed in a meaningful way about the implications and the impacts on women. And so for me, we were close, we were teetering, we were almost there, and then boom, within the span of a year, we have Donald Trump in office. He's promising that he's going to seat only justices who will overturn Roe. That's the first time anyone made that kind of explicit promise as part of a run for office, and in fact did seat three justices who said they would overturn Roe. And then here we are, 2022, June, Roe is overturned. And so it seemed to me as though I started at that moment because it seemed as though the proximity to equality, to full dignity, to real, I keep using the word visibility, but I want to say the visibility of women's lived lives was so close. And then in a heartbeat, it was gone.
And in your first chapter, you also talk about the lock her up chant, which was used during Donald Trump's campaign against opponent Hillary Clinton. Explain the deeper significance of that.
I think at the time, it seemed like kind of over the top anti-Hillary Clinton, right? Crowds just shouting over and over again, lock her up. Over, I guess we should just say in hindsight, feels like fairly minor email violations as compared to what's now being alleged in terms of classified documents and the former president. But I think lock her up for me becomes a metaphor in the book because it's, again, that point I wanted to make when we first were talking about women in the law, because the idea that Hillary Clinton would be put on trial and sent to jail without any real meaningful allegations of misconduct, that she was going to just go to jail for all time because of her emails, and that the idea that the phrase lock her up becomes a thing that is chanted later about AOC. It's chanted about Christine Blasey Ford. It's chanted about Nancy Pelosi. And I think there's not any accident here in the chant of locking up women who speak out, who are a force for justice, who are doing absolutely nothing wrong. And so I guess I just land at the end of the book, post-Dobbs, and you and I know we've talked about this before, but post-Dobbs, we're looking at women who are quite literally locked up in prison in Alabama because they're pregnant and the state believes they're going to endanger their pregnancy. Women locked up in Oklahoma because their miscarriage is deemed to have been fetal endangerment. All around the country, women who are feeling that if their miscarriage has any questionable element, the state can lock them up. And so for me, I think the through line is how, again, in the span of a heartbeat, you go from what seems like frivolous requests that inconvenient or loud or powerful women simply be locked up to women actually being locked up, and how we slid backward into this kind of Handmaid's Tale narrative where women are not in control of their lives because the apparatus of the law is being used against them.
So you talk about a lot of women in this book, and about the minute or so we have before break, I want to start with one that our listeners may not know, Pauli Murray. Why did you include her?
I included her because, in a sense, this book is a meditation about who gets famous and who doesn't get famous. And Pauli Murray should be one of the most famous constitutional thinkers, not just about women's freedom, but also racial justice. And nobody's really heard of her. So I start with her because I want us to really begin thinking about who gets credit and who does the work. And for me, Pauli Murray becomes a metaphor of someone who did all the work in the 1960s and 70s, doesn't get a lot of credit, because I think a lot of the women in this book don't get a lot of credit. They kind of carve the law out of the rock face of what they're given with the Constitution, with statutes, with new rules, and they don't always get credit, but they're doing the work, and I want us to lift them up.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick about her new book, Lady Justice, which chronicles the lives of the female lawyers and judges who challenged the administration of Donald Trump. You can find an excerpt on our website at onpointradio.org. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Dahlia Lithwick is my guest this hour. She's the author of Lady Justice, just out this week. It profiles some of the women in the legal professions who challenged some of the most controversial policies of the Trump administration. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Dahlia, we're talking about some of the women you highlight, and one is Sally Yates, who was, as you write in your book, quote, the first casualty in Donald Trump's war on the Constitution. Yates was the acting attorney general when, just 7 days into his presidency, Donald Trump signed an executive order that restricted travel to the U.S. from 7 Muslim-majority countries. Yates refused to defend it. She spoke about why at an event in 2018.
It was really clear to me that I wasn't convinced it was lawful or constitutional. And beyond that, and importantly, to defend it, it also became evident I was going to have to send Department of Justice lawyers in to argue that this travel ban had absolutely nothing to do with religion. Religion was completely irrelevant.
Right.
And that's in the face of all the statements the president had made, both on the campaign trail and after he had been elected. And I didn't believe that that was a defense that was grounded in truth. And we were the Department of Justice. And I don't think any lawyer should go in and be arguing something that's not grounded in truth, but I sure don't think the Department of Justice should be doing that.
3 days after that order was issued, Trump dismissed Yates for insubordination. Dahlia, why is this story so important?
I think that it's important for a couple of reasons. One, and I want to be really clear, I think sometimes when you relive these things, it's kind of re-traumatizing to remember, oh, right, that was really crazy. They fired the acting attorney general summarily, and they did it because she wasn't willing to defend something that she thought was, as you just heard, religious discrimination on its face. But it's not re-traumatizing because this is heroic. And so I think one of the reasons it sits with me still is that Sally Yates was an institutionalist, right? I mean, she had a deep, deep, long-standing relationship with the Department of Justice. You just heard in her voice that she was not willing to put the imprimatur of DOJ on something that she believed to be unconstitutional, that violated statutes, and that she believed to be religious discrimination. So I start with her in some sense because I love that she was fighting for the Justice Department, not just fighting the travel ban, not just fighting for refugees and immigrants who were lawfully admitted to the country, but standing up for the principle that the Justice Department, without fear or favor, fights for the law and not for the president. And for me, that was a meaningful place to begin. We're right now in the midst of yet another kind of national referendum on the Justice Department, whether it's just lawless witch hunt, unfair going after files in Mar-a-Lago, or whether it stands for something really lofty and important, which is the rule of law. So one of the reasons I start with Sally Yates is because I think she says that so eloquently. And maybe also, Kimberly, because not enough people, in my view, did what she did. Not enough people publicly and loudly proclaimed, I will not do this. I don't care that I'm being ordered to do this. This is wrong. This is illegal. And it's not enough, as we're now seeing in the rearview mirror, to years later write a bestseller saying, I was never really for that. What she did in the moment in real time, I think, was really, really become a standard bearer for the rule of law.
Another woman you highlight is Roberta Kaplan, who was a successful commercial litigator before founding her own woman-run law firm in July of 2017. Well, just days later, on August 11th, the Unite the Right rally took place in Charlottesville, Virginia.
I was horrified at the idea that truly militant, radical white supremacists and anti-Semites could openly march on the streets of an American city. That didn't surprise me because I know we have the First Amendment, but could openly march on the streets of an American city with weapons, intending to cause violence, and then committing violence. That, to me, that was shocking. I didn't think that's what this country stood for. I thought something needed to be done about it. And I was very worried at the time, because at the time, the Attorney General was Jeff Sessions from Alabama, not a man with a great record on civil rights. And I didn't think that the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, which should have been doing something about this, would do anything. And it turns out I was right about that.
So, Dahlia, I know this event literally hit home for you. And so talk about that and Roberta Kaplan and her reaction to those events.
Yeah, it did hit home for me. We had been residents of Charlottesville, Virginia for 17 years when Unite the Right happened in our streets. That was, as I think I say in the book, our synagogue. My children had been, welcome to the world there, and my older son had his bar mitzvah there. So this was very close to home. Those parks where those Confederate statues stood were quite literally, Kimberly, where my kids learned to walk, because it was 10 steps from their school. And so to have this atrocity happen, and happen, as you just heard Robbie Kaplan say, seemingly without raising any red flags for the Trump Justice Department, was really horrifying. And then to have the president, given the opportunity to condemn it, say, you know, there were bad people on both sides, there were good people on both sides, and to refuse to say, no, actual neo-Nazis, actual white supremacists and Klan members marching with torches, saying, get back in the ovens, and making horrific horrific racist claims, and then actually, as you heard Robbie say, causing bodily injury and death in the case of Heather Heyer, that the Justice Department didn't step in. So there's a straight line in some sense between what I just said about Sally Yates and the function of the Justice Department and what you just heard Robbie Kaplan say about the utter absence of the Justice Department. And maybe the last thing I'll say is that this trial for me, which really only ended this past November, a year ago, it was filed in very quickly in 2017, it didn't come to conclusion. It didn't even go to trial until 2021 in the fall, when there was a massive $26 million judgment against all of the organizers and the white supremacists and the Nazi groups. But for me, this is another very emblematic story about somebody who worked for years and years and years, Robbie Kaplan and Karen Dunn and their team, who worked for years trying to do discovery. All of the white supremacists kept dropping their phones in the toilets. They couldn't recover documents. This was really hard toil, often without credit. And it ended up, I think, really vindicating the plaintiffs who were harmed in this case. They didn't get credit along the way. They didn't get much credit when the trial ended. But this is, I think, the work of the Warriors for Justice that I'm trying to profile.
A key part of the Trump administration, or a key thing that happened during the Trump administration, was the Me Too movement. And in your book, you talk about things like the confirmation hearings of Justice Brett Kavanaugh and the accusations of Christine Blasey Ford. And you also talk about federal judge Alex Kaczynski and those who accused him. Again, something that hits home for you. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's strange. There are ways in which all of my sort of experiences, both as a journalist and as a court watcher, in some way inflect in the book. And you know as well as I do that court reporters don't like to talk about their lives, but this was another way in which my life was affected. And I guess I will just say quickly that Judge Alex Kaczynski was and is an absolutely brilliant thinker and jurist. He was the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I don't think anyone believes for a second that he isn't singularly talented as a sort of a wordsmith and as a judge. But it was, in my view, kind of an open secret on the Ninth Circuit for decades that he had very, very punitive and abusive work conditions for his law clerks, that he had showed porn to law clerks, that he said inappropriate things to law clerks. And somehow nothing ever changed. And right around the time that I started writing this book, a few women came forward to the Washington Post, including Heidi Bond, who clerked for him, and Emily Murphy, who clerked for another judge on the Ninth Circuit. Both of them told their stories of what he had said and done to them. And then I was just in this really awkward position of having to decide if I was going to say something about what he had said to me and what I had heard over the years. And after a lot of anguishing, I also wrote a piece in Slate very soon after, explaining not just what he had said. The story wasn't meant to be, you know, I was Me Too-ing Judge Kaczynski. It was supposed to be about keeping secrets and complicity and sort of the power structures in the federal judiciary that let all of us who knew about this become accomplices and witnesses who stood by silently. And so for me, that chapter is less about Judge Kaczynski than it is about me, who kept a secret for a very long time, and how it is possible that in the federal judiciary, people can stay on the bench for years and years and years. Everybody knows, and nothing is done.
And talk a little bit more about that, because it is an interesting phenomenon. I did not have a personal experience with Jessica Kaczynski, but I, as a lawyer, as a journalist, was aware of others who did. And there... Just help us understand a little bit why it is so difficult to talk about things like that.
Well, the facts on the ground just for the judiciary itself, Kimberly, are so really, really, the power structures are just prohibitively kind of reinforced in ways that make it almost impossible. In other words, whatever was happening in Me Too in Hollywood, whatever was happening in Me Too in journalism, in some ways, it's further complicated by the just deeply, deeply dysfunctional nature of clerkships in the judiciary. So again, you know, this clerkship, particularly for Judge Kaczynski, who was considered a feeder judge, who sent his clerks on to the U.S. Supreme Court with like almost unerring success rates. I mean, Brett Kavanaugh himself had clerked for Judge Kaczynski. So these are seen as pipeline judges. And because a clerkship at the Ninth Circuit for Kaczynski leads to a Supreme Court clerkship, which leads to this massive signing bonus, which is the golden ticket for all the good firms that do appellate work, there just is a culture in the legal system that says you take your lumps. You know, we all know that he is who he is, and you endure it for a year because it's worth it for your future. And the reason I think it's slightly different from even what we talk about in journalism in Hollywood is A, that Kaczynski's clerks felt that they had a confidentiality agreement, and Heidi Bond wrote about this and I covered it in the book. She literally felt that she couldn't report and had nowhere to report. But also I think that the judiciary, and we can talk about ethics in the judiciary too, has an almost terrifying system of policing itself, so that there aren't watchdogs, there aren't really good mechanisms to deal with judicial misconduct. And so the judiciary, because it polices itself, tends to make claims like, oh, you know, this is just a family and we take care of our family and our clerks are like our kids. And as everybody knows, that is just a recipe for absolute abuse in the hands of abusive judges.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point. So we said we would get to reproductive rights, and you do in the book. Bridget Amiri is deputy director of the ACLU's Reproductive Freedom Project. She helped represent a pregnant 17-year-old girl from Central America who was being held in immigration detention in Texas after crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. The girl had requested an abortion but was denied. Amiri argued the case at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit on October 20th, 2017.
What we're talking about here is an unaccompanied immigrant minor, 17 years old, pregnant, who's been forced to remain pregnant against her will for 3 weeks now because the government has blocked her abortion decision. Every day she remains pregnant takes a toll on her physical and emotional health.
Dahlia, why did you include this story, and why did you start this book with Hellerstedt and end it with Dobbs?
I wish I could say I was a prophet and I was completely prescient and knew that Roe v. Wade was going to be overturned just a few short months before publication. That is not true. But I did believe, and I do believe, that someone like Bridget Amiri, who was arguing this case, was already raising alarm bells about if the government can, as they did in this case, have a pregnant teen in a shelter, that teen has a waiver from a judge in Texas that allows her to terminate her pregnancy. That should have been the end of the story, right? Anyone else who a judge waives and says, of course you're allowed to terminate, should have been allowed to terminate. And yet in this case, the government held on to her, refused to let her out of the government sponsored shelter, and refused time and time and time again judicial orders to let her out of the shelter to terminate. And in a sense, we're doing that in order to run out the clock so that pretty soon she would just be precluded from getting the medical care to which she had a guarantee. So for me, I think this was a canary in the coal mine story. You know, we talked at the beginning a little bit about the fact that now we are seeing quite literally women in Alabama who should be released from prison who cannot leave prison because the state has determined they must carry to term in prison because they will otherwise endanger their pregnancies. And it feels as though all of this was happening in front of Bridget Amiri's eyes, that what she was seeing at the time in Texas is a harbinger of what was to come, which is privileging the rights of this embryo over the freedom, the dignity, the equality, the constitutional protections afforded to the mother. And so I think it seemed to me that if the Trump Justice Department and the Trump administration could make those arguments in Bridget's case, then they were going to make it in the future. And now we're seeing not just those arguments being made, but that enforcement now being leveled upon women. And it seems to me that it is really, really a signal of where we were going, and probably that this is not going to just end with migrant teens. It's going to be, in half the states. It's going to end in criminalization in some cases, in prosecution of physicians. And that this is really, I think, something that we have to be aware of, that it's not just abortion at the border for immigrants anymore. Now it's huge swaths of people who are being treated the same way. And so It wasn't that I was prophetic. It was that I was worried.
I'm going to have to pause you there as we talk about your book, Lady Justice. I'm with Dahlia Lithwick. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. If you were listening on Monday, you would have heard Meghna talk about a series of shows on the topic of trust the team had been planning for this week. Unfortunately, we've had to pause that series, but it will resume when Meghna returns. You'll just have to trust us on that one. Today, Dahlia Lithwick is here. She's the author of the new book, Lady Justice. It profiles some of the women in the legal profession who used the rule of law to challenge some of the most controversial policies of the Trump administration. Dahlia, I want to continue on the point that we were talking about reproductive freedom, reproductive healthcare access. That's something that is extended far past the Trump administration. Talk a little bit about how women are still at the forefront, even after the overturning of Roe versus Wade.
I mean, I could say Kansas. I could say Alaska, I could say Michigan, right, where we had this small army of women get a ballot initiative in place that would not just kind of codify Roe under state constitutional protections, but would go much further and protect contraception and protect a whole bunch of other elements of reproductive health that are under threat. I mean, it's so evident, and the polling is almost chilling, I think, that there is a massive divide between where women and men are processing what just happened in Dobbs, and that women are engaged, they're worried, they're anxious. But beyond just that, I think it's fair to say that after Dobbs came down, I think enormous numbers of women, and I know I had these conversations that included you at the time, were just shocked. They could not understand how a Supreme Court could essentially nullify not just 50 years of precedent and doctrine, but could also nullify the will of 70%+ of the population who didn't want to see Dobbs disturbed. And so I think that the two prongs that I'm seeing happen right now, and I think this is replacing the shock that women were experiencing in the spring, is both political activism, is sort of stepping in to say, we're going to get this on the ballot, ballot. We care about our governor's races. We're looking to see who our state attorney general is. We are going to fight to make sure that this doesn't happen in our state, whether it's a trigger law or one of those zombie laws that's gone into effect that is harming women. But the other piece of it, which is real deep conversations about structural reform to the courts, thinking about how it is that 9 life-tenured judges could substitute judgment for millions and millions of people who will be harmed. And so I think those two things have really been amplified over the summer. And I think, and I don't want to essentialize, there have been extraordinary men leading these conversations too. But I have really seen an absolute emphatic commitment by women and women's groups, women's organizers, not just to register voters and get out the vote and make sure that November looks and sounds like hashtag Rovember, but also really asking hard questions about the Electoral College and a malapportioned Senate and a misrepresentative Supreme Court and the big structural systems that allowed, I think in this case, the will of the voters to be supplanted by the will of 6 justices.
So the next Supreme Court term starts in just a couple of weeks. I want to preview some of those cases that are coming up in just a bit, including important cases on voting rights and voting access. But first, I want to talk about another woman you highlight in your book on that topic, Stacey Abrams. Abrams has been a staunch leader on voting rights in Georgia. Here she is on the issue last year during an interview on CBS.
When you've never had to think about the hardship of voting, then yes, these conversations about voter suppression seem absurd to you. When you've never spent more than 7 minutes in line, it is nearly impossible to imagine that there are poor Black people who stand in line for 8 hours, miss an entire day's wages, risk losing their jobs simply to cast a ballot in an election that may or may not have any benefit in their lives.
Since 2014, the New Georgia Project has registered 500,000 Georgians to vote. And in 2020, Biden became the first Democrat to win the state in almost 30 years. According to exit polls, 92% of Black women in Georgia voted for Biden. He won more than 2.4 million votes in Georgia, beating out the incumbent president by nearly 12,000 votes. Dahlia, talk about Stacey Abrams and her role in Georgia as we await the hearing of two very important cases on voting rights out of North Carolina and Alabama from the High Court.
Sure. And I want to say just one quick thing about that gorgeous soundbite you just played, which is this is a point that Stacey Abrams makes all the time. It's a point that Professor Carol Anderson made to me in the book years ago when she said, you know, for white people to wake up and say, wait, what? I have to stand in a line in COVID and I, you know, have to get a babysitter and I need water. This is insane. And Professor Anderson reminded me on my podcast years ago, that if you're a person of color in America, you have voted like that probably your whole life. And so when I described this sense of shock and fury after Dobbs, a lot of Black women organizers have reminded me that if you were Black in Mississippi or Alabama or in Tennessee, you never had a right to abortion. You never had a simple trip to the clinic around the corner. You did have to take 3 days. You did have to find babysitters. And so in a way, I love what Stacey Abrams says in that quote, because there is a great leveling going on now, where a lot of people who feel like they are awakened to this horrifying reality are being made to understand that if you were a person of color, this was always your reality. And I love how Stacey Abrams really articulates that in the context of voting. So I was really meticulous to make sure that the last 3 chapters of the book were all about voting rights. Because I think that it's very, very, I think it's very hard to connect voting to the law, but of course voting is essential to the law. And these cases that the court is going to hear are going to, I think, decide not just vote suppression, but the future of the Voting Rights Act and the future of redistricting and gerrymandering in ways that are going to affect everyone.
And what might that look like? I mean, we already had almost a decade ago now, the Shelby County decision that really eviscerated the part of the Voting Rights Act that allowed the Department of Justice to be proactive in protecting voting rights. Now we have left Section 2, which allows people to bring challenges based on either voting districts or voting procedures that discriminate on the basis of race. But that stands in the balance this term. Talk a little bit about that.
That's right. After Section 5 disappeared, what was left, as you said, was Section 2, which is a much heavier lift for plaintiffs to effectuate their voting rights under the Voting Rights Act. And then in Brnovich a few years ago, the court really kind of took a surgical knife and cut away essential parts of Section 2. So now the question is, there still is a Section 2. And in Merrill versus Milligan and Merrill versus Castor, we're going to see a challenge to Alabama's new congressional map. A lower court found that that map was an illegal racial gerrymander in violation of Section 2. We're going to see what the court says about whether Section 2 really has any teeth left at all. And I think that in a sense, we're going to see this progression that you describe that starts with Shelby County and then goes on in Brnovich of really hollowing out what's left of the Voting Rights Act in this area of unlawful racial gerrymanders. And, you know, it's maybe a good thing to remind folks that nobody until Shelby County said that, the right to vote wasn't the cornerstone of a functioning democracy. So this plus, I know we're going to talk about the independent state legislature doctrine, but these cases that are going to make it harder for voters to represent their will at the ballot box is a thing that is, I think, very, very much going to be one of the lodestars of the court's term to come.
And let's talk about that North Carolina case about the independent state legislature. It sounds something like something hard to understand, but it could be really impactful. Tell us about that.
I think it sounds like something hard to understand, and we have to just kind of strip all the technical jargon away because, in my view, it is, I think, the single existential case and the single, in some sense, existential threat to the right to vote. So it is doctrinally really complicated, and it is, and I think a lot of legal scholars would say there's not actually a lot of doctrine there because it was, it's not a theory that has a lot of legs. It's something that is largely pulled from academics and think tanks and Chief Justice Rehnquist's opinion that only actually got 3 votes in Bush v. Gore. So it's not actually the law, but it is essentially at bottom a theory that says that nobody can tell a state legislature how to run their elections. And there are extreme versions of this argument that would carve out state courts from reviewing state legislatures, that would even carve out the state executive from doing anything about a state legislature's decision about how elections are run. But in the most extreme version, I think you could really connect this back to what Donald Trump and his lawyers like John Eastman were trying to do in 2020, which is say to states like Georgia and Pennsylvania, doesn't matter what the voters said, the state legislature gets to decide. They can create a slate of electors and send it to be determinative of who won the Electoral College. So I think at bottom, and tell me if I'm overstating this, this would immunize state legislatures from any scrutiny and essentially say they have plenary control over future elections. And that would really, in a deep, deep sense, mean that what happened in 2020 could happen again, or what almost happened in 2020 could happen again in 2024, except instead of coming by way of phone calls to state legislatures, it would happen in black robes and with the imprimatur of the court.
It's really amazing to think that if neither state courts or the governor's offices can do anything about how the election is determined in a state, that is That's really mind-blowing, but that certainly is what this case is about. So Dahlia, in just the couple of minutes we have left, this upcoming term is just full of so many consequential cases. There's affirmative action. There is another case about a web designer who doesn't want to design wedding websites for gay couples. There is a case about the EPA, about immigration, about the rights of Indian parents and children. What are you looking for, and what do you think women in particular, in that special relationship with women and the law that you've detailed in your book, in the year ahead as the court takes up these really consequential cases?
Well, for starters, I think I would say those election cases we just talked about that, you know, we've both now stipulated they're technical, they're wonky. Oh my God, gerrymandering is like so difficult to explain in ways that don't send people's faces into screensave, right? But I think we have to really understand that if women are angry and they're organized and they're voting and they're registering, then these election cases can still thwart popular will. And so I would say, you know, start with Merrill, the case we talked about in terms of gerrymandering, and then very much Moore v. Harper, the case we just talked about in terms of the independent state legislature doctrine. And I think there will be challenges that race up to the court that are follow-ons to Dobbs. And we're certainly hearing talk of personhood amendments. We're hearing talk of Lindsey Graham's proposed 15-week federal abortion ban that would take the power that was just given to the states and give it back to the federal government. So I think there are certainly abortion questions ahead. But maybe I would say the single most important thing that not just women, but anybody who's kind of worried about what we saw happen at the court last year is going to be watching are these legitimacy questions. Are, you know, we've got the Supreme Court has approval ratings that are the lowest in history. They started last term with the lowest approval ratings in history. Last week, John Roberts gave a speech in Colorado saying, oh, poo-poo, you know, nobody should delegitimize the court because they hate the decisions. I thought it was interesting that it was Elena Kagan, a woman, who made a speech in last week in New York saying, no, the court is delegitimizing itself. And more urgently, as she said, and the dissenter said, not just in Dobbs, but in other cases, we need a court that is legitimate. You cannot have rule of law in a country. You cannot have a constitutional democracy if the population thinks that the court is in the tank for, in this case, I guess it's fair to say, the conservatives and the Republican Party. And so I think one of the things really that folks who are worried about what happened last term should watch for is not just these consequential cases, as you said, in so many areas, LGBTQ rights, the environment, Native American rights and tribal rights, and the administrative state, all that is on the table. But I would say more urgently, this question of whether the American people believe that the court is still a court. And if and when the court itself decides the 2024 election, will the American people have confidence that that was a neutral, fair, just application of law? Or is this just a political branch swinging for the fences? And I think for me, that animates all of my anxiety going into this term.
Well, Dahlia Lithwick is the author of Lady Justice. You can find an excerpt of the book on our website, onpointradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Dahlia.
Kimberly, it's always wonderful to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.